the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the listeners who support this program. Two guys named James, James Balk, James Swift, Deborah Newell, and Leanne Rayer sets a good example. She just canceled her $5 monthly subscription and doubled it to $10. Do what you can do. Go to peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and our voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month. In the second portion of this podcast, we're going to talk to Colonel Anne Wright. She served in the United States Army and in the State Department, and has been an activist for peace. Among other things, she'll be on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, departing in mid to late June, and she has some strong comments about President Obama's speech to the State Department on Thursday, the 19th of May. We get commentary on the president's speech as well from J. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics, chair of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco, who joins us from Mexico today. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Nice to talk with you. And are you on the Yucatan Peninsula?
Actually, I'm right in the heart of Mexico City right now.
Oh, you are. Okay. Well, it's great to talk to you no matter where you happen to be. And I wanted to get your thoughts about the president's speech to the State Department. We understand now that he delayed delivering the speech by well over half an hour, as he was getting very negative advance feedback from the Netanyahu government via Secretary of State Clinton. And he says he made some changes to the speech, but not the portion about Israel. And what's fascinating, Stephen, is the coverage here in the United States has blown by the overall focus of the speech and really only looks at the last 13 or 14 paragraphs dealing with Israel and Palestine. So first up, tell me your thoughts about President Obama's position, as he defined it in the speech on Thursday, regarding the long-running dispute between Israel and the Palestinians.
Well, yeah, he reiterated what the broad international consensus has been for many, many years, that there should be a creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel based on the pre-June 67 borders, that... with some minor and reciprocal border adjustments, and that security guarantees, there are security guarantees for Israel. I mean, it's pretty moderate mainstream stuff. So, you know, the fact that there would be this right-wing reaction is just so ludicrous. I mean, essentially what he's calling for is a Palestinian state on maybe 20% of historic Palestine. And the other Republicans and the Netanyahu are saying, oh, no, that's too much. You know, the Palestinians should have even less than 20% of Palestine. And frankly, those of us who are familiar with international law, familiar with the issue there, recognize that there are several serious problems with what Obama said. And that, for example, he talked about the... mutually agreed upon swaps of land that Israel could hold on to these illegal settlements by which, according to international law and five UN Security Council resolutions and a landmark decision of the World Court, they should withdraw from. He said, they can keep those settlements, but in return, get the equivalent amount of land that's in what's now Israel, and add that to the Palestinian state, so they won't at least get less than the 22%. But he ignores the fact that the Palestinians have accepted that idea, and Israel's rejected it. meaning they made no mention that the Palestinians are ready to deal with this kind of thing. And, but he said he's not going to pressure Israel. He's not going to, make it dependent on the aid Israel depend on and its cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. But the most upsetting thing he said was that it was going to, that issues about the refugees and about the fate of Jerusalem would be settled after this Palestinian state was established.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea of the Palestinians accepting a state where their largest city, where most of the Palestinians are located, what has historically been the cultural and business and religious center of Palestinian life, still under Israeli occupation, you know, without, and then, you know, with no deal struck to include at least the Arab parts of the city into the Palestinian state, that may be a non-starter right there. So, you know, one would assume, and indeed most of the world is saying, Obama's speech was anti-Palestinian and didn't lend up to Israel's international obligations under international law and the like. But weirdly enough, here in the United States, the flag is coming from the other direction.
Yeah.
It really boggles the mind, especially being out of the country like I am right now.
Well,
and just sort of the reaction here and among other internationals, and then reading what people are saying in the United States.
Well, I can certainly understand that. It's an unusual feeling when you are abroad, when major issues like this take shape and are covered in the American media, and you get a whole different perspective when you're outside the country. And Stephen, my reaction to the speech was that the president tilted slightly from the historic American posture, but only slightly. And if I put it this way, in the past, it has been expected and we have delivered 1,000% support of Israel at all times. And the president dialed that back to only 900%. And still, that is seen as a serious breach of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And that by and let me read this critical paragraph from the president's speech. He said, "As for Israel, our friendship is rooted deeply in a shared history and shared values. Our commitment to Israel's security is unshakable, and we will stand against attempts to single it out for criticism in international forums. But precisely because of our friendship, it is important that we tell the truth. The status quo is unsustainable, and Israel, too, must act boldly to advance a lasting peace." Now, there he pledges continuing allegiance to Israel and says, because we love you, Israel, we want you to make some changes and recognize that the status quo can't continue. And yep. while I deplore his promise to stand against attempts to single Israel out for criticism at the United Nations, that's what he's referring to, I understand the play there. And even with that attempt to mollify the Israelis, they won't be satisfied without really a total commitment to their commitment to the status quo.
Exactly. I mean, Israel has the most right-wing government in its history, and you have Republicans and some Democrats even parroting the line of this far-right Middle Eastern government that somehow has this idea that conquest and occupation and colonization and repression is a way to security. I mean, you have the Palestine Authority, FATA, the Palestine Liberation Organization, virtually all the countries in the Arab League has put forward in their peace plan are willing to recognize Israel's right to exist, to strict security guarantees just on 78% of Palestine, just withdraw from the occupied territories and give the Palestinians the right to a homeland on that 22% remaining. And yet you have people saying that is somehow unreasonable.
And I do agree that the president has sharpened his position. He has defined it much more explicitly than he has to date. I think that's a good thing. And with the withdrawal or the resignation of George Mitchell as his special envoy to the Middle East, the president didn't mention Mitchell at all in the speech. It's unclear who his point person will be going forward, but it does seem that he tried to frame this as a response to the Arab Spring. And while I'm not happy with everything that he had to say, I do appreciate that he is trying to frame a coherent American policy toward the region, and that he is sending a gentle, loving nudge to Israel that they've got to give if they're going to get any real security or peace.
Very much so. And again, this is a very moderate position. It's one that is has articulated by the by much of the Israeli public, by a majority of American Jews, in fact. Again, it is so moderate. Indeed, as I mentioned, there are some serious critiques about, you know, for those of us who who believe in international law and recognize the significance of Jerusalem and don't think that Israel, Israel is indeed singled out in some cases, but in other cases they very much deserve criticism if they're in violation of international law and everything. There are a number of things. There are legitimate critiques from the other direction, but I don't see how people can possibly interpret what the president says the least bit anti-Israel, the least bit lessening of a commitment to Israel's legitimate the right to peace and security.
Well,
is the argument that indeed Israeli generals and leaders in the security have said that we cannot maintain this occupation; it's destroying us.
And Stephen, the comment about standing against attempts to single Israel out for criticism. The most recent example was January, when Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, lodged the veto at the Security Council over a resolution critical of Israel for continuing to expand its illegal settlements. Now,
that was not singly Israel. There are only two countries in the world that are currently engaged in that kind of illegal colonization. And it was simply reiterating a fact that has been broad consensus international law, clearly in the Fourth Geneva Convention, set in no less than five previous U.N. Security Council resolutions, supported by both Republican and Democratic presidents, not to mention a landmark decision by the International Court of Justice. There's no question that these settlements are illegal. And the fact that Obama chose to veto them raises serious questions about his commitment to international law.
And I wish that in his speech he would say that we cannot continue to protect Israel from international criticism for its illegal settlements.
Right. Again, it is certainly true that Israel has been unfairly singled out at times, but it is also fair to say that the government is violating a whole series of international legal norms, and that no more or less than any other country, they need to be held accountable.
And, Stephen, I know you're outside the country, but you probably are connected enough that you know that the president did receive pushback from the Netanyahu government even before he delivered the speech. He delayed and apparently made some changes, but he says not about the portion on Israel. And I read an advanced text of the speech and didn't get to compare it to what he actually said, so I'm not exactly clear if he did knuckle under and make changes. But it appears the White House strategy was to get out in front and to establish the Obama position before Netanyahu met with him here on Friday at the White House and before Netanyahu's speech to Congress next week and also before Obama's speech to AIPAC in Washington next week.
Mm-hmm.
So
he did seem to want to be out on front. How he's going to react to the insult coming from the Israeli government, a government that American taxpayers pay close to $3 billion a year to support. The big test, I think, is whether the president is going to say, we're not going to put up with being treated this way, given everything we've done for you, and this is how it's going to be. End of story. And if you don't like it, we'll withhold some of that $3 billion a day we use to prop up your government. But unfortunately, given Obama's history of caving to right-wing pressure on everything else, foreign and domestic, I'm not holding my breath for that.
No, I wouldn't hold my breath for that either. So, Stephen, I wanted just to enumerate for you some of the right-wing reaction here in the United States. I tuned into a right-wing radio show hosted by a New York guy named Mark Levin yesterday, and his very first comment was, well, the question we're going to talk about is this: why does Obama hate Israel? Then Jay Sekulow, who is a right-wing activist attorney in Washington, published an online post, and his headline was, Obama sides with terrorists over Israel. And, you know, this kind of extreme reaction to what are really rather minor moves in U.S. policy sends a really powerful signal. And to me, that signal is that the Netanyahu government isn't really interested in any meaningful discussions and will use any available pretext to avoid coming to the table with the Palestinians.
I think it's a very, very fair analysis. And, you know, they also send the signal, for example, if you think kind of line any of us heard back in 2003, if you oppose the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, you hate America. If you oppose the U.S. invasion and occupation, you're siding with the terrorists. It's the same kind of rhetoric. It's simply applied to a particular U.S. ally. And but it's just as much nonsense. And I think it's important to point that out, that this is the right wing has used throughout the Cold War and then subsequently to make any kind of moderation, any kind of middle ground that goes against a particularly right-wing imperialist position to sound like treason. And I think it shows they're running scared, frankly, because polls show the vast majority of people are, you know, in support this kind of tough love approach towards Israel, rather than telling it straight, making clear that we support your right to peace and security, but you don't have a right to invade and occupy and oppress and colonize other nations.
And, Stephen, I'm on the email distribution list of a wide range of parties interested in the Middle East issues, and I was pleasantly surprised to receive an email analysis of the president's speech from David Harris at the National Jewish Democratic Council, because they are expressly pro-Israel, but they are not as hardline as AIPAC and maybe even are a little to the left of J Street. But Harris wrote, "It's laughable to suggest that Obama insisted Israel return to the 1967 lines or that he said anything different from the policies of Presidents Bush and Clinton before him." And he went on to say that the president offered unprecedented statements of pro-Israel support and pragmatic solutions. And I found this refreshing to hear from a staunchly pro-Israeli group that recognizes that the president is trying to strike some sort of balance, and it's not even a center balance, but he's trying to move from the explicit and unified position in support of everything Israel does to a position of trying to nudge them to the bargaining table.
Yes, and I would actually give more credit that I think he has taken a stronger position, I think, than Clinton or Bush. Clinton's support for the Barak proposal in the summer of 2000 would have greatly expanded Israel beyond 67 without land swaps. And certainly Bush, by supporting the Sharon plan, which would annex even larger parts of Palestinian territory, Obama has, it was unspecific, implied that that Israel would have to be closer proximity to the original borders, and again with some mutual and fairly small land swaps. So I think he has actually put a more realistic position than either Clinton or Bush did. But I think the main thing that they're underscoring is certainly true, that this is a position that leading Israeli politicians, not ones currently in government, but leading Israeli political figures have advocated for years. There's nothing at all unreasonable or radical about this.
And, Stephen, the other factor that I think is very important to chew on here a little bit is that in the speech, Obama recast the catch-22 that Israel uses regarding Fatah and Hamas. And he said that the Palestinians must come up with a credible answer to the question, the profound and legitimate question posed by the alliance of Fatah and Hamas. And nobody bothers to remind Americans that Hamas came to power as the result of an election. Yes, democracy that Bush insisted go forward over the objections of Abbas, the Fatah leader, because he knew he was going to lose. So the elections produced a victory for Hamas, and then Israel says, well, we won't deal with Hamas, and proceeds to further punish the people who live on the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli position, which Obama implied that he supported, that even having Hamas in a handful of cabinet positions would question whether the Palestinian Authority was even a legitimate party at all to the negotiations.
Right.
In other words, if there's one party in the coalition that doesn't support Israel's right to exist or doesn't agree to the Quartet principles or anything like that, then the whole government is illegitimate. But, of course, you could say the same thing for Israel. Israel has these far right-wing parties that don't recognize Palestine's right to exist, that have rejected previous agreements, et cetera, et cetera. And, in fact, one of the first principles of the Quartet, in fact, in phase one, is to freeze settlements, which the Israeli government has refused to do. So if you can say that, hey, we can question whether there should be a negotiating partner with the Palestinian Authority because they're in a coalition government that includes some members of Hamas, you equally question whether Israel should be a legitimate negotiating partner. But the fact that Obama has said that, of course, Israel, that's a given that Israel is a legitimate negotiating partner, but the Palestinian Authority may not be, I mean, that's an incredible double standard that Obama's putting out there.
And here's my example, Stephen. Give me your reaction. It would be as if Hamas says, we won't participate in any peace talks with the Israelis as long as Avigdor Lieberman is still a part of your government.
Exactly.
All right. Well, in the minutes remaining here, because I know you need to run to another appointment, I wanted to ask you for your reaction to the front part of the president's speech, where he responded to the liberation movements in North Africa and the Middle East, and tried to, and I think he was partly successful and partly not, tried to enunciate a broad set of American principles related to these aspirations of liberation on the part of the public in these different countries.
I thought there were some really eloquent segments of that part of the speech, and I really appreciate his awareness that where he seems to acknowledge where power ultimately comes from the people, from their willingness or unwillingness to cooperate with the legitimate authority. And I was impressed with the rhetoric, but, you know, in practice, the U.S. is still the world's number one supplier of arms and security assistance to Middle Eastern dictatorships. It was refreshing, for example, for him to criticize the government of Bahrain for its repression, but he didn't call on King Hamad to lead the transition to democracy or get out of the way, which is the rhetoric he used in the previous paragraph regarding Syria's President Assad.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So again, we sort of have this double standard that dictatorships we don't like on Syria will come down a lot harder than dictators we like. He did not. He criticized Iran for allegedly taking advantage of the unrest in Bahrain, but he said no word to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, who sent in troops to brutally suppress the pro-democracy movement there. And the irony, of course, is we have a lot more influence on Bahrain because of all our security assistance and arms sales and the fact that we pay millions and millions of dollars of rent for the use of their facilities for our Navy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, again, there's some real eloquence in the words. There's a clear double standard at work. And I think you think if the United States is really, truly interested in democracy, we need to stop propping up these dictatorships.
Well, I agree with you. I think that the rhetoric is inspiring and hopeful, and to the extent that it represents where he hopes to be in the future, and that actions and policies will start to be reshaped around it, I think it's a good thing. It's what he left out that concerns me. And in particular, he really didn't address what's going on in Egypt and the extent to which we are trying, for example, to keep the Muslim Brotherhood from gaining power there And, you know, are we really in a hands-off mode in Egypt? I doubt it. But he really didn't offer us much.
We have some influence there. But, you know, I think we are afraid. I mean, let's be honest. The United States is concerned about having even secular nationalists, especially those of a left-leaning perspective, which there's still quite a few in Egypt, be in charge, because an Egyptian government that's accountable to its people is going to be less willing to go along with U.S. prerogatives than a friendly dictator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the long term, this is really great for U.S. interests, because when you have democracy, you're less likely to bring to lead to this radical Islamist reaction and other extremist movements and terrorism that grow out of dictatorships. So in the long term, the more democracy, the better, I think, in terms of U.S. interests. But he's also getting a lot of pressure from, you know, elements in the State Department and Defense Department and others who would just assume us back the military that's still kind of running things and is still engaging in political arrests and detentions and is suppressing a lot of the pro-democracy efforts still. There's still a battle to be waged in Egypt for full democracy. The biggest threat is not from the Brotherhood, I'd argue, but from the military.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, I thank you for your time today. Thanks for talking with us from Mexico City. And I'm sure we'll have time to reflect on this again in the future as we see how it plays out. But it is a very interesting set of issues, and the response from Israel and here in the United States, both fascinating and a little chilling all at the same time.
Good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Stephen Zunis, professor of politics, chair of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco. Next on the Peter B. Collins Show, we get a different view of the situation in the Middle East and a number of other issues as well. Colonel Anne Wright returns to our program today. She served in the United States Army and rose to the rank of colonel. She then worked for the U.S. State Department and resigned her post in protest of the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And she joins us today from New York. Colonel Wright, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Peter Reed Collins. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I just appreciate and respect the work that you're doing, and you're involved in so many different projects. We're going to try to cover as much as we can today. You've been active in Code Pink for Peace, the Gaza Freedom Flotillas, and there's another flotilla coming up. We'll definitely talk about that. You've also been very active on the issues of women in the military being subjected to sexual harassment, abuse, and rape, a very significant issue. Let me start with the president's speech to the State Department on Thursday, May 19th. And it's very interesting because he tried to present a new vision of American policy in response to the so-called Arab Spring. And the president's speech was positive and promising in some respects and frustrating in others. But I do think that it's important that he present an idea of how we're going to deal with the various different aspirations that are being played out on the Arab street. And while I don't believe he resolved the inconsistencies and contradictions that I see in, for example, the difference between our policy toward Libya and our policy toward Syria and Bahrain, he did take a stab at it, and I give him credit for that. He also laid out some more explicit positions on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute than we have heard since he became president. And while he made no mention of recently resigned envoy George Mitchell, he did seem to put his personal prestige on the line to try to restart talks between Israel and the Palestinians. This is also in front of the visit Friday of Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel to Washington. The AIPAC conference in Washington, the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee, that gets underway this weekend, and the president will speak to them next week. And then he's going to round this up with a speech to a joint session of Congress. So I give the president some marks for taking on these important issues. What are your thoughts about, in particular, the expressions he made about Israel and Palestine?
Well, I, too, am pleased that he came forward after 2 years since his Cairo speech in 2009. In fact, I was in Gaza when he made that speech in 2009, where we really were looking forward to a change in U.S. policies, really, from what he laid out. But for 2 years, we've been waiting, and essentially nothing has happened. And in fact, as you mentioned, the special envoy, George Mitchell, resigned last week, and the jury's still out on exactly what happened, but one could say nothing happened, and he was fed up with it. What the president has laid out, and I'm not just intimately familiar with all of the things of the speech, but the things that stood out to me were that, you know, it's still the protection of Israel, and that Israel's security is the primary thing that the United States is looking for, and also to protect Israel from any criticism from the world. And to me, those two things are, the first one, yes, every country has a right to protect itself, but when it does it at the expense and the invasion and occupation of other countries, that's what we've always been concerned about on the West Bank and in Gaza, the essential occupation by having the blockade around Gaza. The criticism, sparing Israel, the criticism, the U.S. will always be the big brother, protect Israel. I think it's very dangerous for Israel as well as the United States, because there is legitimate criticism that should be laid at the feet of the Israelis for killing 1,440 people in Gaza in 22 days, wounding 5,000, for their onslaught in Lebanon in 2006, for 9,000 Palestinian prisoners in their jails, for attacking and invading Gaza very frequently, for their checkpoints, apartheid walls that are in the West Bank, for the illegal settlements. All of these things are worthy of criticism. They must be criticized, and I am disappointed that the president does not recognize that it's usually just Israel, the United States, the Marshall Islands, Palau, and Micronesia say that Israel should not be criticized. All the other countries of the world criticize rightfully Israel for its actions. The parts of how you get to a two-state solution, the 1967 borders, how the Palestinians and the Israelis work to have a contiguous Palestinian nation, that's going to be a challenge. The three settlements that Netanyahu says that the illegal settlements that are in the West Bank to have large Israeli population centers, illegal population centers, but he says they want them. How Israel can possibly say, they're illegal? Well, they won't say they're illegal, but they are, but we want to keep them, and we want to keep these walls around them. We really want to be a thorn in the side of the Palestinians in what little land they have left. You know, the Palestinians only have less than, after 1948, the Palestinians got 48% of the Palestine mandate. The Israelis got 52%. And the Palestinian 48% is now dwindled down to like 22% because of all of the illegal settlements, the encroachments on Palestinian territories. So there's very little of it left.
I think, Anne, it's important to point out, a lot of Americans have a very fuzzy concept of these Israeli settlements, even if you call them illegal. And they think of them as, maybe mobile homes or trailer parks or tent communities. These are very elaborate urban-style developments with condominium complexes and, very detailed urban economic centers. These are not just a few settlers camping out in open territory.
Well, that's right. And many of the settlements, you're right to call them, they should be called, like suburbs or condominium complex. Those are paid for by with United States money. Some of it comes from the U.S. government. A lot of it comes from fundamentalist Christian Christian organizations, and some of it comes from Jewish organizations who are paying for those. It's like the suburbia, Southern California or Florida, the things that have been built up there. And yet when you see right next to the, on the other side of the apartheid wall from there, will be Palestinians who are living in very difficult circumstances with very few roads. With, I mean, it just, the contrast is startling. And some of the most vocal opponents of what Israel is doing are members of the Jewish faith who have gone to Israel on trips and never realizing, as you mentioned, that this existed, this dichotomy existed like this, and they are horrified when they see it.
Yeah. And let me read a couple of lines from the president's speech here to get your reaction, because some of it, as I say, is promising, and it shows an effort on his part to go beyond just some of the bland diplomatic statements that he's kind of safely used in the past. He says, precisely because of our friendship with Israel, it is important that we tell the truth. The status quo is unsustainable, and Israel, too, must act boldly to advance a lasting peace. He goes on, the international community is tired of an endless process that never produces an outcome. The dream of a Jewish and democratic state cannot be fulfilled with permanent occupation. He goes on, a lasting peace will involve two states for two peoples. Israel is a Jewish state and the homeland for the Jewish people, and the state of Palestine is the homeland for the Palestinian people, each state enjoying self-determination, mutual recognition, and peace. And he goes on to describe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their potential, and these are key words, in a sovereign and contiguous state. So these are pretty forceful definitions from this president, and it's more explicit than we've seen really since he became president.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is, and it does provide enough details in what the U.S. proposes as a part of the settlement process or negotiations process. It does give some openings for real negotiations on this. However, when you really look at what the policy of Israel has been from the very beginning, and if you look at a movie called Occupation 101, you'll see every prime minister of the state of Israel saying publicly that the goal of Israel is to get as much Palestinian land as they can. So I don't think Bibi Netanyahu is any different from the rest of them. And trying to get the Israeli government to say that they will stop taking Palestinian land is one of the reasons why there is no peace settlement right now. In my opinion, and I'm certainly no expert on this, but from my look into it, it sure seems to me the policy of Israel is just to get every bit of land and to keep putting off every American president, no matter what type of proposal they make. It's never good enough, or it's never this or that. And in the meantime, if you look year by year by year, the amount of Palestinian land that is being taken, either by a new illegal settlement or the expansion of the apartheid wall that continues to cut off Palestinian villages from and take Palestinian land, and also the increase in the no-go zone in Gaza, which essentially is just squeezing that 1.6 million people that live in that tiny little place called the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm. And here's a paragraph that I found troubling in the president's speech. He says, in particular, the recent announcement of an agreement between Fatah and Hamas raises profound and legitimate questions for Israel. How can one negotiate with a party that has shown itself unwilling to recognize your right to exist? And this is a catch-22. One more line from the president. In the weeks and months to come, Palestinian leaders will have to provide a credible answer to that question. Now, the reason I call it a catch-22 is that Israel and the United States forced the hand of Fatah to conduct the elections in 2006 that brought Hamas to power. So this was the democracy that is the overarching message that the president is supporting in this speech at the State Department. Yet we joined the Israelis in shunning the outcome of that election, trying to use every available means to marginalize Hamas, further locking down the Gaza Strip, preventing cash, food, and clean water from being made available to the entrapped population in Gaza. And now, when there is at least some rapprochement between Fatah and Hamas, after 2 years of Israel refusing to engage in meaningful negotiations with Fatah when they were at odds with Hamas, now that there is some prospect of unity among the Palestinians, there is this new reason of why Israel can't sit down and talk with the Palestinians.
Well, and the president just parrots the Israeli line on this thing, that you can't deal with anyone who says that your nation should not exist. There are endless recorded statements from the senior leadership of Hamas that have renounced that part of their earlier charter. So what the president is doing is just taking the Israeli propaganda on this thing. But it's something that we need to call his hand on, and Hamas needs to come out as a formal statement, because many of their senior leaders have said that, but they need to come out and say it is the policy of Hamas. The state of Israel should exist, but the state of Palestine should also exist.
Mm-hmm.
And get that cleared away, because it's used as the thing that's the showstopper, and in fact it should not be, because they've already renounced that.
Well, and I have to say, whether it's in dealing with North Korea, with Iran, or with Israel and Palestine, the idea that you can have preconditions to negotiations between conflicting parties is ridiculous. In order to have, any meaningful talks, you cannot pre-arrange or pre-resolve the most contentious issues between the parties.
Well, that's right. And for the United States to keep trying to pull the card that is, there can only be a peace agreement if the United States brokers it. Well, the United States is playing catch up on this thing. When Egypt, the new government of Egypt, the interim government, is moving very quickly and has had the talks between Fatah and Hamas that have led to what will become, it looks like, a unity government. The U.S. is really far, far behind the power curve on this. They're trying to get their foot back in the door, so that the U.S. can be seen as trying to broker something. And on one level, I can certainly understand it, because America's image is pretty low in the Middle East and North Africa. But how they do it is very important. And while there are glimmers of light in this speech, there are other parts of it that, to people in the Middle East and North Africa, they will say, well, the president of the United States has his fingers crossed behind his back on this thing. So I certainly hope that somehow this will push the Israelis to enter into negotiations with a good spirit. They should. I mean, if they really look at what the forces are that are moving in their region, and they claim the only democracy in the area, which is, of course, a false claim, because Palestinians who are Israeli citizens are barely third-class citizens in that country. There is no democracy in Israel for the Palestinians. So it's a real false statement. And for a lot of other immigrants that are in Israel, it's a very racist state. And this whole idea that the U.S. keeps cropping up, too, that it's the only democracy in the region, is so incorrect.
Yeah. Well, and as I look at the text of the president's speech, there are roughly 13 paragraphs that deal with Israel-Palestine. And the one that I cited, where he criticizes the Palestinian parties, is number 12 out of the 13. What I think will be interesting is to see the order that these issues are presented in when he speaks to AIPAC. And I bet you a Lincoln, a $5 American bill, I don't do Benjamins, that the part about Hamas and Fatah will come up much earlier in his speech to AIPAC than it did in this speech to the American public at the State Department here on Thursday.
I suspect you're right, and I think we could probably write the speech that he's going to give at AIPAC. It's pretty predictable. He will start out with Israel as the America's closest ally, that we will always protect Israel. The state of Israel must exist from all forces, no criticism, you know, all of that. And you know, people will be standing on their feet cheering and cheering and cheering. So I think that's what he's going to go after. And then he will hammer in on Hamas. And while he's doing that inside, we will be outside as a part of what's called Move Over AIPAC, which is a citizens conference that is being held at the exact time of AIPAC, where we have brought in wonderful speakers who will be giving a counterpoint to what's been going on in that AIPAC conference.
Great. And is there a website for Move Over AIPAC, or do you know?
There is. It's called Move Over AIPAC, all one word, .com.
And AIPAC is AIPAC.
That's right. And you can also go to the Code Pink Women for Peace website, because it's sponsored. The primary organizer is Code Pink.
Mm-hmm. And, Ann, let me jump to another topic, but with a little transition here. I am looking at the AIPAC website, AIPAC.org, and their first entry is that President Obama will be speaking at their conference, and their second is that a group of pro-Israeli members of Congress has written a letter to the Turkish government asking them not to participate in the upcoming third week of June Gaza Freedom Flotilla. And here is a fascinating line, and I just ask your honest response. The last line of their entry about the flotilla says, "A flotilla dispatched to Gaza last year contained weapons for use against Israel and led to a violent confrontation with Israeli soldiers." Now, just how much historical revisionism have they accomplished in 11 and a half months there?
Well, quite a bit of it. As a person who was on that Gaza flotilla last summer, I was on the Mavi Marmara at one stage for 3 days and then moved on to what was called the Challenger 1. All six ships were attacked. We did not attack one Israeli ship. There were no weapons that were found on any of the boats.
And now let me just offer the quote here. "The ship contained weapons for use against Israel." Now, even in the heavily edited one-sided video that was released by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, in advance of the real-time video from people on the ship, they made the case that some of the people on the Turkish ship did grab spoons and kitchen utensils and broke up a deck chair and attempted to defend themselves against this assault in international waters by Israeli soldiers who were rappelling down from helicopters. But there has been no indication from anywhere that there were weapons for use against Israel bound for Gaza in the flotilla last year. That is a flat-out lie.
It's definitely a lie. And the reason that passengers on the Mavi Marmara broke up the chairs and part of the railings is, now we know from investigations that have been made, is that Israeli commandos were firing bullets from their helicopter. They killed people on top of that ship before they dropped those soldiers down.
Yeah.
And even though this was a voyage for nonviolent action to break the siege of Gaza, when you see people that are being shot and killed in front of you, I suspect that when they saw those soldiers coming down, they saw blood on the floor, that people had already been shot, that's what happened. But there was not one rifle, there was not one pistol, nothing like that. There were some kitchen implements that were there, but that was it. There were no weapons, and it is a flat-out lie. you know, the Israeli government has a tremendous diplomatic offensive going on right now in response to the flotilla that will be going in less than 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
They have visited all of the countries in the region, in the Mediterranean region. They've gone up into Europe. They've come to the United States to demand from governments that they not let citizens go on these boats and that the boats not be allowed to sail from countries in the Mediterranean. They are feeling the pressure, and this is just one form of citizen pressure, international citizen activism that's going on against what the state of Israel is doing. Another very potent thing that's happening now is the boycott, divestment, and sanctions program that's going on worldwide against the state of Israel to force it as boycott, divestment, and sanction programs were very important in undercutting what racist South Africa was doing. This is the same type of thing that we're doing for Israel, and it's having an effect on it.
Yeah. Now, I read one account, and I only saw it once and didn't see it corroborated, that Israel was publicly saying that it's contemplating not trying to block this new flotilla effort the third week of June. What is there? Do they have a defined posture, or is there some ambiguity at this point?
Oh, it's definitely an ambiguous situation. There was that. It wasn't really a report from the government, as I understand it. It was a newspaper account saying that could be a possibility.
I see.
What we do have from the mouths of government officials is that Israel has every right to use any force that they want to include killer snipers, attack dogs being lowered onto the boats. So they're not ruling out anything. And if you look at what happened on Monday morning, where a Malaysian boat called the Spirit of Rachel Corrie, a cargo ship, left the port of El Arish, Egypt, and tried to get into Gaza and was met with gunfire from Israeli commando ships, forcing it to stop. And the commandos did not board it, but apparently an Egyptian ship, military ship, came up, and the Egyptians told the ship to come back into Egyptian waters, where it still is, not being allowed to go into the port of El Arish, and their fuel and water and food are now getting low. So they're kind of stuck outside the port of Egypt. But the Israeli force was to shoot at the ship but not hit it, but mm-hmm. to send a warning to it not to come in.
Well, thanks for informing me about that. My media outlets have been jam-packed with sex scandals, and that's the first I've heard of that little altercation.
Yes, it's a major one. There were, I believe it was 17 kilometers worth of piping, sewage piping that was on board that cargo ship to go into Gaza to help repair the sewage system that was destroyed by the Israelis 2.5 years ago, and with now raw sewage still going directly into the Mediterranean because the Israelis will not let materials come in to repair that sewage thing. It was really critical to try to get that piping in.
And I can hear an Israeli source saying, well, you know, sewage pipe, it's dual use. You can use that to launch a rocket from, and that's why we can't allow it in.
It would be a very big rocket launch from a tube like that.
Well, but that's how far-fetched some of their exclusionary arguments are. So, Anne,
right.
if you could, tell us what outlines of the flotilla look like at this point, and is there a ship that will be called the Audacity of Hope? Because I've already got the T-shirt.
Well, good for you. We're glad you've got that shirt, and you were very helpful in our purchasing of a boat, and we do have it. In fact, I was on it last week. It is about 100 feet long. It'll hold 60 passengers. It is called the Audacity of Hope. It will have that on the stern of it. It will be a U.S. flag vessel. On the sides of it, we will have in giant letters, U.S. Boat to Gaza. It will be one of 10 to 12 ships that will be a part of this next flotilla that will be going the third week of June. It will possibly have over 1,000 passengers on the various ships, and it will be a big, big international citizens appeal to the Israeli government to stop that brutal blockade of Gaza, to let us go into Gaza, to offer the supplies that we have, but more important, the political, it's more of a political mission rather than a humanitarian mission. We are trying to break this siege to get the Israeli government to stop this illegal siege of Gaza.
And where is the best website? I've got the Gaza Freedom March. I've got an Irish Ship to Gaza website. But where is the central website for the upcoming flotilla?
Well, first, our U.S. boat to Gaza, our website is us2gaza.org.
Okay.
And the overall, you can find a link to the main Freedom Flotilla website, freedomflotilla.org.
Okay.
You can get a link from our U.S. to Gaza website.
Okay. And in the past, the websites have included real-time video feeds and up-to-date reporting. Can we expect that on this round as well?
Absolutely. On board the Marvi Marmara, the ship that was attacked and 9 people killed and 50 people wounded, because of extreme pressure the Turkish government put on the Israeli government, that ship was returned to Turkey. It was painted so there was no blood left on it. Most of the equipment was taken off of it, destroyed or stolen off of it. But it has now been re-equipped by the international humanitarian organization called IHH. And it will have a complete television studio on it and facilities for uploading television and radio and news media. On our smaller ship, we will have an internet connection through a satellite phone, and we'll be able to upload small amounts of video and small numbers of photos, but plenty of stories that will be written by the passengers on our boat.
Great. Well, you've got my full support, and I will be watching very carefully your progress coming up in June. Now, Anne, I want to turn to two other issues that you have been active on and championed. You testified on behalf of those who were arrested last year at the Creech Air Force Base near Las Vegas, which is one of the command and control points for the unmanned aerial drones, the Raptors, Predators, and others that are flown over Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and who knows where else. We've also deployed them over Libya recently. And I believe one was sent to Japan to overfly the troubled nuclear reactor there. So we've got these deployed all over the place. And I thought that they were all controlled from Creech, but you recently were arrested at Hancock Air Force Base outside Syracuse, New York. Tell us what you know about the activities at Hancock, please.
Well, the proliferation of drones within the U.S. military is happening. And National Guard bases throughout the country, to include March Air Force Base in California, Beale Air Force Base in California, people are being trained to operate drones in those locations. And I joined with hundreds of people in the Syracuse area on April 22nd to protest what's going on at that Syracuse Hancock Air Force Base. 37 of us were arrested for disorderly conduct. We were very disorderly as we laid down in front of the main gate of the facility. We had people in wheelchairs, to include Jerry Berrigan, brother of Daniel Berrigan and Bill Berrigan. He's the remaining Berrigan brother that's alive. He's in his 90s, and he did not get out of his wheelchair, but he locked the brakes on it and stood his ground, or wheelchaired his ground right there. We had several people in their 80s. It was really interesting, the number of first-time arrestees, people who are saying that they are now willing to come forward and get arrested as a symbolic gesture for their outrage of what these drones are doing in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen. And, you know, it's one thing to have an unmanned aerial vehicle that might do positive things for humanity, like flying over a nuclear power plant that has exploded. I think that is a good use of a drone.
Yeah.
But when it has weapons on it and when it is killing people and the faulty military intelligence and CIA intelligence, which we know is the source of endless civilian casualties, deaths in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is something that we feel strongly that we must stand up and say, this must not continue.
Well, I certainly support that. And let me just interject here and ask you for comment, because I've been recently expressing myself, recognizing that I'm in a sharp minority. But I'm very troubled by the manner in which we dispatched Osama bin Laden without offering any proof of the guilt that we say is just so obvious to the entire world. And from that, just 4 or 5 days later, we launched a drone assault in Yemen, a country that's riven by civil war right now, and attempted to take out an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, who has neither been charged nor convicted of even disorderly conduct at an Air Force base. And the American public and our media and our political leaders silently and passively appear to support this type of assassination, summary execution. And I'm very troubled by this, because I think that while many Americans are smug and righteous about it and just think all this is justifiable and that it even amounts to justice, it's perceived very differently in the parts of the world where we're attempting to repair our reputation.
Well, it certainly is. And if, you know, America is supposed to stand for that you're innocent until proven guilty, not until you get assassinated by a drone or commandos coming in and point blank shooting at you, killing you. You're unarmed, apparently, is what Osama bin Laden was. It is a horrific blight on what America is supposed to stand for. It's certainly in the last decade, what America is standing for is nothing that I am pleased about at all, and that's why I resigned in 2003 in opposition to the war, particularly in Iraq. But what we did in just going in and just murdering Osama bin Laden, rather than putting him to trial, and granted, of course, the trial would be difficult. It would be contentious. It would... the security problems would be substantial, but that's the way our system is, or it used to be. Now it certainly seems that we assassinate people rather than giving them a trial, and we put people in the lockup for 9 years, 10 years without giving them a trial. We still have over 150 people that are in Guantanamo right now who've never been tried, and yet they've been in jail now 10 years. So America has become a very different place, and this idea that after 9/11 everything changed. Well, everything changed by the politicians who wanted to change America, become a Gestapo state, a security state, and it's something that I am just apoplectic about, and it is something we have to push back on in every possible way. Even President Obama, with now the whistleblowers, you get no help at all. Mm-hmm. For whistleblowers. You get prosecuted as a whistleblower now for exposing graft, waste, corruption, or criminal actions by others in the government.
Well, and in some of his comments today about the aspirations for freedom expressed in the Middle East, he made comments that unfortunately contradict his own policies here in the United States. And it is troubling that we're able to promote freedom, liberty, and in some cases democracy for other people, and we're not quite practicing what we preach. And finally, I want to turn to a difficult issue that you have been very front and center on, and I really appreciate and respect what you've been doing, because against the backdrop of the resistance to lifting the ban on gays openly serving in the military and the homophobia that that has unleashed both on an overt and covert basis, we have been ignoring the very difficult situation faced by women in uniform and the widespread sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and rape, including command rape, that has occurred and apparently continues to occur. And I wanted to get just your latest update on who is listening on these issues, and are you really getting any traction, in your view, toward exposing the abuses and finding ways to make the military a safe place for women to serve?
Well, we have instituted a class action lawsuit against the Department of Defense on behalf of women and men who have been sexually assaulted or raped in the military. We filed a suit in March, and it forced the military to respond. It forced three-star generals to say, we have zero tolerance for rape in the military. We are working on creating a better atmosphere within the military so these things will not happen. So we are getting yet one more era of commentary from the military of, oh, this will stop, you know, we're going to stop all this. Well, the rapes still continue. The numbers are of reported rapes are increasing every year. 10% of the rapes that were reported last year were reported by men. In fact, there was a Time magazine article about 3 months ago on rape of men in the military. If you think it's hard enough for a woman to acknowledge that she has been raped in civilian life, much less the military, think about a guy coming forward to saying that his buddies have raped him.
Yeah.
This class action lawsuit is flushing out a lot of things. It's forcing the military to, I think, face a little more squarely the fact that they really do have a big problem here. A lot of military folks would just kind of brush it aside, saying your statistics are just wrong. It's just not, that's not it. But as we keep pushing and pushing and more people start writing about it, as more organizations are formed to help victims or survivors of sexual assault and rape, and they become active in advocacy for them, going to the Congress, and then we have new allies in Congress, and we now have a woman member of Congress who says that every week that the Congress is in session, she will be speaking about the issue of sexual assault and rape on the floor of the House of Representatives.
And let me name that person, because it's Jackie Speer of California. And my former producer, Katrina Rill, is the District Communications Director for Congresswoman Speer. And I know Katrina has been very central, and it's your influence, Anne, on Katrina that I think helped her persuade Congresswoman Speer to make this an ongoing effort. So I only want to mention that to circle back to you and give you credit for really raising awareness of this issue and being persistent in that effort.
Well, thank you. I'm just thrilled to hear that. You never can tell, you know, who might be listening or where, and when they end up in a position where they might be able to use their position and influence to really help a particular issue. So I'm just thrilled that that's happened.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and I'll when we're off the air, I'll send an email to you so you can connect with Katrina and make sure that she's getting the latest information on the efforts of you and groups allied with you. And it really troubles me, Anne, because you have exposed very widespread and significant sexual abuse, and there has been spotty coverage. Occasionally, a major news outlet will cover an individual case, but it's really troubling to me that the alleged rape committed by the now resigned and disgraced Frenchman who headed the International Monetary Fund is getting a great deal of attention. But the cases of individuals in uniform, particularly lower-ranking service members, don't get nearly the attention they deserve or the over-the-top tabloid coverage that we're getting out of the New York case right now.
Well, it truly is amazing. Between what's happened on the IMF chief, now resigned, if you look at what Arnold Schwarzenegger's child born out of a relationship with one of the household staff there, and we still don't know the circumstances of that, it is disheartening in a way that when you keep having year after year after year thousands of men and women in our military who are raped by others in the military, and the institution itself will not take action to make sure that this doesn't happen. And I can tell you, they can make sure a lot of other things don't happen, and they can be pretty tough with people when issues of on all other types of issues come up.
Yeah.
But on this one, we still have this old boys network that, you know, boys will be boys, and, oh, you know, you're just a little 19-year-old girl. You don't even have a career here. Why are you going after this sergeant? You know, he's got a family, he's got a career, and you're just nothing. And it's that sort of stuff that is that we are trying to get the military to recognize, that you have to treat people properly in our military. And it's a difficult thing to get over on the senior leadership. So we continue to work, but one should, if any family member of any of the listeners is thinking about joining the military, that's something they ought to ask the recruiter. What's the issue on sexual assault and rape in the military? And if he or she won't tell you anything about it, really question them. Do some reading up on it, because everybody ought to be aware of what's going on. And the military is a predatory organization.
Ann, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for all of the activism that you engage in, and I certainly wish you safe passage to Gaza in June. We will be monitoring that as closely as we can.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Peter B. Collins.
Colonel Ann Wright, here on the PBC Show. Here's to peace in the Middle East in my lifetime. Is that too much to ask?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.